the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines: Israel refusing to release a Palestinian hunger striker at imminent risk of death. The World Health Organization warns over half of Yemenis are struggling to put food on the table, with 3 in 4 kids severely malnourished. Also, the U.S. and Chinese presidents hold their first online meeting for a discussion on a range of conflicts between the world's two biggest economies. Thank you for joining us. Well, our top story this hour: Israel's top court has dismissed an appeal for the immediate release of a hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner who is at imminent risk of death. This is the fourth time the Israeli Supreme Court has rejected a petition submitted for the release of Kayat Fasfus. A Palestinian commission for prisoners says the rejection shows the Israeli officials' indifference and deliberate criminal disregard for the life of inmate. 34-year-old Fasfus has been on hunger strike for 125 days in protest at his indefinite detention without charge or trial. 4 other Palestinians are also refusing food for months over their so-called administrative detention. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has expressed support for the detainees and called for urgent international action to save their lives. In order to get further updates and details on that story, we have Mona Candil, our correspondent in Ramallah, on the line. Mona, thank you for joining us. It's good to talk to you. So tell us more about, the Israel's top court and its decision to dismiss the appeal for the immediate release of the hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner.
We can say that Kayat Al-Fasfus is facing life-threatening conditions. It's serious, according to his lawyer, to the doctors, and to the Palestinian Commission of Prisoners and Ex-Prisoners Prisoners Affairs. That's why the commission appealed to the Israeli High Court in order to accept the release of Kayat Al-Fasfus. The release of Kayat Al-Fasfus, or at least accept ending his administrative detention, because only then Kayat Al-Fasfus will end his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. Kayat Al-Fasfus is now in one of the Israeli hospitals in the hospital of Barzilai, according to his doctors, speaking to his brother that he might face death anytime, and that his family members, the Palestinians, Palestinian Authority, the different political groups, as you have mentioned, also Hamas movement, they are urging the international community to pressurize the Israeli regime to end his administrative detention, especially that administrative detention means Israel keeping Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. The United Nations and the European Union has repeatedly called on Israel to either prosecute those Palestinian prisoners or release them because there are no charges against them. Today we are speaking about Kaid al-Fasfus and other four Palestinian prisoners are on an open-ended hunger strike. On Thursday, the Israeli prison authorities or the Israeli regime accepted the in the administrative detention of Durgham al-Qawasmi, another Palestinian who was in serious condition after numerous appeals by his mother urging the whole world that to save her son, especially that he was in a very serious health condition. The Israelis accepted the end of his administrative detention and that he would be released next February. So he accepted to end his hunger strike after over 111 days.
Mona, where is Kaid al-Fasfus kept now?
Well, Kaid al-Fasfus has been transferred first to Israeli hospital, but then he was returned to the prison clinic. Now he was again transferred to Israeli Barzilai Hospital. They are keeping him there. The Israeli regime rejects to deal with his legal demands because they don't want more Palestinians, especially administrative detainees, to start another hunger strikes and to, in according to them, these hunger strikes would be pressurizing the Israeli regime to accept their demands and end their illegal detention. So the Israeli authorities refuse to deal with the hunger strikers' demands unless they are literally on the verge of death. And this is what happened with Miqdad al-Qawasmi last Thursday. And this is what's going on now with Kaid al-Fasfus.
And one last question. Are the prisoners who are on hunger strike, including al-Qawasmi and Kaid al-Fasfus, in the same prison or they're kept at different prisons?
Well, those Palestinian prisoners, of course, they are administrative detainees, but they are in different Israeli jails. We are speaking about over 20 Israeli jails across the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. The administrative detainees are from all the Palestinian cities because administrative detention gives the Israeli regime a green light, according to their laws, to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. Their lawyers and they themselves do not know what they have done in order to be arrested. Mm-hmm. But the Israeli regime keeps saying that they have secret information they cannot unveil, and that's why they keep people for indefinite periods of time behind bars. That's why we have been seeing repeated hunger strikes by Palestinian prisoners.
Mona, thank you so much for joining us and all the details that you provided us with. I've been talking to Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Now, breaking news from the occupied West Bank, where Israeli forces have shot dead a young Palestinian man. Local media are reporting that the man was killed during an armed confrontation. The Palestinian, identified as Saddam Hussein Bani Udde, got wounded while resisting arrest by Israeli troops in the city of Tubas hours ago, but he died of his injuries later. Israeli forces launched a campaign of raids in the area at dawn, triggering the clashes. They took away an unknown number of Palestinians during the operation. Israeli organizations and military sites have been targeted by major cyber attacks over the past months. A hacking group called Moses Staff now says it has acquired sensitive information on the location and characteristics of Israel's vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. More in this report.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group, which calls itself Moses' Staff, has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data, which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, 6 Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnea. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations, but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
A United Nations monitoring mission in Yemen has called on the warring sides to hold new talks over the western port city of Hodeidah. The mission said the withdrawal of Saudi-backed forces from areas near the strategic city and the Yemeni army's advancement marks a shift on the front lines. It added that the developments warrant fresh discussions between the two sides. The call came a day after Saudi warplanes targeted an area east of the city of Hais in Hodeidah province, killing 3 civilians and injuring 7 others. That's despite a UN-backed truce reached in 2018 that called for the cessation of fighting along the Hodeidah front. The Ansarullah movement has said it expects the deal to lead to peace, but instead, Saudi Arabia has continued to violate the ceasefire, killing and injuring thousands of Yemenis ever since. The World Health Organization has voiced concern about the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen, warning that 75% of children there suffer from acute malnutrition. The WHO also said that over 16 million Yemenis are facing food insecurity. That's more than half of the country's total population. Previously, the UN Security Council warned about the increasing risk of severe famine in Yemen, exacerbated by the poor economic situation. Yemen has been mired in crisis since a Saudi-led coalition launched a devastating war on the country in 2015. Around 80% of the country's population is now in need of humanitarian assistance. Political commentator Eric Wolberg says the condition of Yemenis would improve once the U.S. stops funding and arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition. Listen.
It's terrible, and it could be ended immediately if the U.S., if Biden would just stand by his election promise to stop funding the Saudis. But as with many of his promises, he has backtracked and not fulfilled them. So this is another one where he's gone ahead and proposed further funding of Saudi aircraft and Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman, has put forward a motion to stop funding the Saudi war machine. This is the same motion that went that was 3 times vetoed by Trump. Biden makes these futile gestures without doing any real policy. So I don't know if perhaps there will be this move on the part of Congress to stop the funding. Maybe that will end the U.S. funding. That is the only way you're going to get the Saudis to back down, if they finally see that they aren't getting their arms as they wanted before.
Iran says there is consensus among the participants of the 2015 nuclear deal that the U.S. is to blame for the current state of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a phone call with his Italian counterpart, Luigi Di Maio. Iran's top diplomat noted that some of the participants to the deal have acted irresponsibly by staying silent in the face of the U.S.'s excessive demands. They said their inaction led to the current situation. Di Maio, for his part, expressed hope that the upcoming Vienna talks will end in the intended results and help Tehran and Rome boost their bilateral ties. Earlier, we were joined by political commentator Richard Becker, who gave us his thoughts on the Iran nuclear deal and the developments since the U.S. withdrawal from the accord.
After Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, announced the unilateral and I believe illegal withdrawal from what was essentially a treaty, the partners of the United States who were part of it and members of the Security Council, meaning of course Britain and France and also Germany, which is not in the Security Council but one of the negotiating partners in this, that they all said to Iran, no, stay in the agreement. We'll find ways to overcome the problems that you now face because the U.S. has pulled out. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen in any kind of a significant way at all. So the deafening silence, I think, is the correct way to put what the allies of the United States, how they have reacted to the United States' unilateral withdrawal from the treaty. I think the Iranian government has gone out of its way to maintain adherence to the agreement. And we had Biden, when he was running for president, indicating that he would restore the U.S. to the deal, but never intended to do that without exacting more sanctions, which the Iranian government understandably is not willing to do.
U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping have held a virtual summit to discuss areas of disagreement and ease tensions between the two countries. Biden called for, quote, common sense guardrails in bilateral relations so the competition between the two does not veer into conflict. He said they had a candid discussion and promised to address areas of concern. Xi, meanwhile, said the two nations must strengthen communication and face challenges together. He called for mutual respect and healthy bilateral relations to deal with global challenges like climate change and COVID-19. Tensions have in recent years been mounting in the Sino-American relationship over a host of issues. Those include the coronavirus, trade, technology, Hong Kong, Taiwan, human rights, and foreign interference. The European Union has decided to impose fresh sanctions against Belarus amid deepening tensions with Minsk over a migrant crisis. The decision was made during a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Brussels, where they agreed to amend the 2020 sanctions against Belarus. Before the meeting, one of the ministers accused Minsk of violating human rights, saying severe economic sanctions against it is inevitable. The EU accuses Belarus of using migrants to reach its objectives against the bloc, an accusation Minsk has dismissed as absurd. About 4,000 people have been stranded at the country's border with Poland. Warsaw has deployed additional guards at the border to push back the migrants. Well, that's your war news for now. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate.
Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In remembrance of our innocent Lady of Qom. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and condolences to you on the doleful day of the departure from the world of our innocent Lady of Qom, Hazrat Masume, peace upon her, the Immaculate Daughter of Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we present you an exclusive feature in this regard, here is Ayah 72 of Surah Tawbah, in which God Almighty has promised the bliss of paradise to the true believers. Allah has promised the faithful, men and women, gardens with streams running in them, to remain in them forever, and good dwellings in the gardens of Eden. Yet Allah's pleasure is greater than all these. That is the great success. According to a famous hadith, true believers laid to rest in the soil of the holy city of Qom will enter paradise straightway on the day of resurrection without having to stand for the final judgment. This is indeed a divine favor for those of the faithful destined to repose eternally in the city from which it is said Satan has been banished forever, as per a lengthy narration of the wonders encountered by the Almighty's last messenger to mankind during his Mi'raj, or ascension to the highest point in the heavens and back to earth in a part of a single night. It is proof of the sanctity of this city on the edge of the Iranian desert, whose fortune was suddenly transformed from obscurity into a center of learning, worship, and pilgrimage by the appearance of a venerable member of the Prophet's household a millennium and 2 centuries ago. She was the namesake of the Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatimatu Zahra, peace upon her, and her direct descendant in the 6th generation. She was the daughter of Imam Musa Kazim, peace upon him, the Bab al-Hawaij, or the Gateway of Wounds, who reposes peacefully in the sprawling mausoleum in Qazimain, near the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. She was a lady of superior intellect, virtue, and merits, to the extent that she is considered a pride of the Virgin Mary, the mother of Prophet Jesus, peace upon them, in view of her epithet, Ma'sume, which means the innocent lady. She was on her way to Khorasan to meet her dear brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, who was forced to reside by the Caliph in the city of Marv, presently in the Republic of Turkmenistan, when brigands affiliated to the Abbasid regime attacked her caravan near the town of Save, some 128 kilometers southwest of modern Tehran. She inquired about the distance to the city of Qom, and on being told that it was near, decided to head towards it. The people of Qom, on learning that the 7th Imam's daughter was about to grace their city, were filled with extreme joy. The notables of the city went out to greet her and escorted her caravan to Qom, a tradition that continues to be symbolically commemorated till this day every year on the 23rd of the month of Rabiul Awwal. Alas, after a brief 17-day sojourn, Hazrat Fatima Masume, peace upon her, failed to recover from the fatigue of the long journey from Medina, and on the 10th of Rabiul Thani, her soul flew to the ethereal heavens. On hearing of the sad departure of his 29-year sister from the mortal world, Imam Reza, peace upon him, gave the tidings. Whoever visits Masume in Qom is like the one who has visited me. The fact that Imam Reza, peace upon him, uses the term Masume instead of the proper name of his sister speaks volumes of the lofty status of his immaculate lady. Later, her nephew, Imam Muhammad al-Jawad, peace upon him, also expressed a similar statement, promising believers the rewards of pilgrimage to the shrine of his learned aunt. Whose city? The Haram, or sanctuary of the Ahlul Bayt, as prophesied decades earlier by her grandfather, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, is one of the 8 gateways to heaven. Without the least doubt, Masume possessed an exceptionally exalted status, and that is why Qom has become elevated in the sight of God Almighty. Born in the Prophet's city, Medina, in 173 AD, corresponding to 709 AD, her status as a scholar of repute was established when she was less than 10 years old. It happened that a group of Iranian pilgrims, after performing the annual Hajj to Mecca, visited Medina both for homage to the Prophet's shrine and paying of respects to the Prophet's successor, Imam Kazem, peace upon him. They had a list of some very important scientific and jurisprudential questions with them, posed by the people of Iran to the Imam. They were rather dismayed, since Imam Kazem, peace upon him, was not in Medina. They decided to hand over the list of questions to the holy household before returning with full confidence that the answers would be sent to Iran through a messenger whenever the Imam returned. However, to their surprise, before they could restart their long return journey, a servant of the Imam approached them with the scrolls containing the answers to their queries. They glanced at the replies with satisfaction. But to their utter astonishment, when they asked who had provided such interesting answers, they were told the Imam's less than 10-year-old daughter, Fatima, peace upon her. The Iranian pilgrims were men of profound faith, and with thanks to God Almighty for his favors, they resumed their journey. On the way, however, at a caravanserai on the highway, they had an encounter with Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, who was returning to Medina. Beaming with joy, they saluted the Imam, were warmly received by him, and during the conversation showed him the answers they had received from his young daughter. The Imam read the questions and answers and remarked with an expression of gratitude to the Almighty, Fedaha Abuha, which means, may her father be her ransom. Today, pilgrims from all over the world flock to her shrine in the city that has become the center of diffusion of true knowledge all over the world, to pay homage to her and seek her intercession with God with the words, O Fatima, intercede for me for the reward of paradise, for certainly you have with God a lofty status. Here are a few phrases from the standard form of salutation at her holy shrine. Peace on you, O daughter of Musa, son of Ja'far. May Allah shower his mercy and blessings on you. Peace on you. May Allah grant us your companionship in heaven and place us in your group and lead us to your prophet's fountain and quench our thirst out of your grandfather's own cup in the hand of Ali. May Allah bless you all, I ask Allah to grant us, through you, happiness and ease, and to place us and you into the group of your grandfather, Muhammad. May Allah bless you all. Truly, He is the guardian and is almighty. I seek nearness to Allah through my devotion for you and through my enmity for your enemies.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In Seville.
The water erupts and flows through the Alcázar Garden, part of Seville, Spain, in which the royal household is located. This place is also considered the official area of the central government. More than 10 centuries ago, Muslims ruled over this land. Abdulrahman III, Caliph of Córdoba, ordered the construction of these buildings. That was when the historical triangle of big Islamic capitals of Andalus, Cordoba, Granada came into being. Gradually, Alcázar became the center of cultural life in the city. Alcázar is also a prime example of architecture that shows the elegance of a civilization, which is still an immeasurable part of the Al-Andalus identity. This majestic example of architecture, even after being recaptured by the Christians, retained its elegance and was developed by Muslim architects once again. Outside these walls, Giralda can be seen. The mosque's minaret is adjacent to the Alcázar Castle. This minaret, which is currently being used as the Catholic Church steeple, became the international symbol of Seville City. This is one of the famous historical landmarks in the capital city, Al-Andalus.
Historically, people, academia, and politicians have always noticed the importance of the Islamic Seville in its own era. Seville played an important role, both in the time of war and peace. Even today, the name of Seville can be found in political books. There are also other proven facts, such as immigrants that can be seen in the streets or working in institutions in the city of Seville.
Every day, thousands of tourists, mostly Muslims from every corner of the globe, visit their historical heritage. They can't help thinking about the past, the time when things were better for Muslims. This statement holds true for this neighborhood and the ones on the outskirts of Seville, where many Muslim immigrants, mostly Moroccan, reside. This neighborhood has been devastated by economic strife, unemployment, and a lack of social resources. The basement of this building, which isn't easily noticed, is one of the 6 mosques in the town. Perhaps it is better to describe it as something more like a hall for the Muslim community to perform their religious rituals in. This place is located among the malls and business centers that used to thrive in the past.
Assalamu alaikum, yo soy Jihad.
Hi, I'm Jihad Sarasua from Seville, Al-Andalus. I'm a Muslim. We are in Ishbilia Mosque that we built in the Maid's neighborhood, so Muslims could perform their rituals. This is one of the popular neighborhoods of Seville, where many of us are living together. This mosque was built to meet today's needs of the Muslim community. This is all we have in this neighborhood. This neighborhood belongs to the working class, so this place is okay considering the fact that there is no business or social centers here. We have to, as Muslims, build up a community in such a poor condition. But we need a place where Muslims of Seville can get together to display the true image of Muslim communities, right? Yes, of course, we need that. We are working hard to get what we want. We need a proper neighborhood to show the splendid image of Islam in Seville.
Probably asking the municipality on behalf of the Muslim community of the city would make them grant us a loan. We could use it for Bujaira Mosque, located in Mila de Oura, Seville. We also have historical background in our favor. The constructions will be close to the Alcázar Castle, one of the greatest preserved treasures from the caliphates. There we meet Javier Fito, one of the residents of Seville, who is defending his Muslim community's right to a place where they can perform their rituals and congregations.
As far as I know, most of the mosques are in the basements of buildings. Sometimes these places get really crowded and there is also a lack of space under standard conditions. In the best case scenario, we can only have access to emergency exits. We don't even have the basic conditions here. Trying to have the right place is what we can do to make this situation better. Mosques are supposed to be social centers and community spaces, just like Catholic churches or any other social centers. We should have a better place for public use. What we have right now is still far away from what we have in mind. These places are really cramped. These buildings are not designed for religious purposes. Therefore, problems like poor standards of hygiene arise.
This is what the Muslim community has been struggling against for 25 years. These struggles started when some people in Seville who had converted to Islam openly asked for a proper mosque. While other religious communities had a better situation, they continued to struggle because they had to gather in unsuitable places to pray together.
There are some lecture halls for praying in the basements, lower floors or on the outskirts of Seville. There is no congregational mosque in Dole in spite of efforts to have one.
The idea of building this mosque became a contentious issue in the 90s. At that time, I was a member of the city council and I held the position until 2003. It all started when the Muslim community went to the municipality to get them convinced to have a congregational mosque. Well, personally, I believe that almost everyone in the municipality and political parties there liked the idea, because the idea had a sense of mutual respect and religious freedom. It's quite natural, isn't it? So, different religions can have their own place to perform their rituals. There could also be some other aspects in addition to having a mosque. At the beginning, it seemed that there was no problem with it. There were talks about renting a place for that purpose in Seville, somewhere that had traces of Islamic traditions. Everything passed so quickly and there was no result. They noticed it would be problematic to convert an old church into a mosque in the center of the city. They wanted more than that. It was more affordable to have it built in a new neighborhood. That was when they looked at Bermejal as an option, right?
This is the mosque in Seville. The only accepted and known mosque in the city that we can talk about as a mosque without any inhibitions is this one. Especially when the famous footballer Frederick Knut bought this place and gave it to Al-Ikhwan Al-Muslimun, who, after some failed attempts to build a mosque, took the initiative and managed this place.
tomado esa, ese relevo por nosotros, lo cual, el cual
we gathered at Al-Andalus Parliament to talk it out with MPs and PSOE. Then we asked for the place, just like what other religious communities had, a place with good conditions and enough space for public use. Then we officially registered our request, and after 2 months we got our answer. We had an agreement to allot a place to the Muslim community. It was out of the city with no other buildings around, and we had no other way but to accept it. After a while, we noticed it wouldn't be that bad in the distant future. We accepted it, and we did the paperwork, and we even got the deeds and documents.
Now they had started working on the construction of this mosque on the land which belonged to the Muslim community. The responsibility was given to this young architect from Seville, and they started the project with a predetermined fund of more than 3 million euros. This mosque was supposed to be one of the biggest mosques in Europe, a building of 3,000 square meters, two floors, a capacity of more than 2,000 people, a public yard and a private parking lot. A mosque which would finally give the Muslims of this city a place to congregate. And of course, the rest of the people of Seville would be able to enjoy the modern atmosphere of the place, in which followers of different religions and schools of thought could gather to swap ideas and information.
El volumen principal, como no puede ser otra forma, es la nave que hace de oratorio.
The original structure was a ship of two floors with a dome covered by green tiles. Undoubtedly, genders are separated in accordance with the Islamic law. So the first floor would be used by men and the second floor by women. In the center, we have two hollow places leading to the dome. And in the front, we have the qibla with a somewhat upward slope to show a symbolic feature which can only be seen in a mosque. Around the main yard, we would have different services. Some of them were considered for public use and some of them more private, such as a halal restaurant, a cafeteria, a library, and a place for other cultural activities, originally designed to be used as a cultural environment for public use.
Now that we had the land, the project was presented, accepted, and funded to start. Everything was ready to end 10 years of marginalization. It was almost impossible for the growing number of Muslims in Seville to dream of a mosque, but then everything went wrong.
Soon, a rumor went around that a mosque was going to be built, something that wasn't easy to hide. It didn't seem bad or something that neighbors wouldn't like. The idea of building a mosque wasn't against the society or any other religious sects. Well, it's hard to find an old church in the city center district. It's obvious that we can't find a space in the city center. That's why the idea of building new neighborhoods came up. Normally, in an old neighborhood, the government had already monopolized the lands and any other construction activities. Everything was running smoothly until the neighbors found out about the mosque and they reacted badly against it.
The neighborhood was biased against building a mosque. Bias, yes. Most of these immigrants from the West are economically down. And in most cases, they cannot even meet their basic needs. It's not right to think of keeping the poor and the immigrants away from yourself. We shouldn't forget, not too long ago, we had the same situation when we had to emigrate to France or Germany. I think all we needed was a smile and more support instead of xenophobia.
This is Conchita Rivas.
She has been the chief of the Bermejales neighborhood since it was established. She is one of the public figures against the construction of the mosque. They claim they have no intention of insulting the Muslim community. They simply prefer a medical clinic to a mosque. Today, they are passing by an abandoned land with no mosque or any other construction in the public interest.
At the beginning, it was mentioned in the press that Muslims want to build the biggest mosque in Europe. We went to the municipality for some explanations, and they said that it had already been planned and there was nothing we could do about it. I told them that Bermejales community had also a part in making decisions. We'd had other important plans on the agenda and they hadn't been actualized yet. This is why we disagreed. However, we held a referendum in Paseo de Europa Park to decide the issue. In addition, on our left side, we had a related opinion box for saying yes or no to the mosque. There wasn't even one ballot paper in the ballot box.
A partir de ese momento en el que se hace esa asamblea informativa,
then we received information indicating that anything bad could happen. We tried the idea two times and they opposed us each time. We tried to sort things out. We talked to them and we talked to the press to tell them they had no right to treat us like animals. Behind all this, there were also children at the school to whom the idea of xenophobia was indoctrinated by the neighbors. This issue was spreading nationwide. On the internet, we could see anti-mosque posts on websites from across Spain, Valencia, Madrid. We received emails and messages that had no indication of the term coexistence.
These documents and newspaper pieces are about the mosque project lawsuit, the project begun by the Muslim community. It was interesting to see the unusual presence of the National Intelligence Center at different stages of the whole issue, and both sides of the struggle mention this.
Yo fui visitada por dos agentes del Centro Nacional de Inteligencia.
I met with two officials in the National Intelligence Center. These people were trying to convince me that I had to forget about the whole thing. But I had my goals. I have always fought against injustice, ignorance, and whatever I'd find insulting. I told them that I wasn't going to give up.
Nuestras relaciones con las organismos de información del Estado son directas.
We were in direct contact with the CNI itself and the CNI police.
Desde el CNI hasta a la policía.
In every aspect, we were frank and direct. We had nothing to hide from the society.
Es decir, nosotros no hemos ocultado ni tenemos nada que ocultar a la sociedad.
After a long lawsuit, the Supreme Court voted in favor of the neighbors and the municipality was criticized for poor decision-making. Now, the municipality was trying to find a new place for the mosque. The new place was on Cartuja Island, where international exhibitions used to be held in 1992, a combination of abandoned, transferred, and constructed lands for educational and business purposes. The entrepreneurial community of Seville was the last to oppose the construction of the mosque. We chose three places: a church, a piece of land for public use in a newly built neighborhood, and a piece of land in an area for public services. Three projects, three hopes, three failures. But the Muslims did not give up. They chose another piece of land to buy in a neighborhood of San Jeromino. Once again, the neighbors took to the streets and the same scenes took place.
Even some extremists buried a pig in the land chosen for the construction to make fun of Islamic law, which asserts pigs are unclean. The truth is that they wanted to stop them from building the mosque, no matter what. Finally, the whole project came to a halt.
I believe that this issue, apart from being politically motivated, was a problem of coexistence. And also another crucial factor can be the lack of understanding a civilization or a certain way of thinking. I think all these contributing factors sat the mosque project. Personally, I truly believe that Muslims in Seville deserve a proper mosque.
It's hard to believe that a city like Seville, which was ruled by Muslims for more than 5 or 6 centuries with its Islamic background, has no place for Muslims to perform their rituals. Most of the neighborhoods oppose the idea of constructing a mosque, although more important issues can be found in these neighborhoods. We are in San Jeronimo, La Macarena. Since the time of economic crisis, this part of the city has been hit by depression. These people are losing everything. Yet, they demonstrate not against these crises, not against unemployment or their violated rights, but against their neighbors who want to build a place to do their rituals, simply because they don't understand the metaphysical values behind it. These people have no reason to stop the Muslims to build a mosque.
Whoever wants to be the Seville mayor has to know that the city needs a place to represent the Muslim community. Honestly, according to our constitution, our city deserves such a place. We will try to find another way with the help of the private sector to get this project done, and we hope to make it happen in the years to come. An unofficial census estimates the population of the Muslim community to be around 10,000, representing at least 20 different nations. Most of them are converted Spaniards, Moroccans, and others from southern parts of Africa.
In the limelight.
Prices of everyday items in the U.S. have surged during the pandemic, thanks to a toxic combination of staffing shortages and supply chain woes. The rising prices are souring the national mood and taking a political toll on President Biden. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of NPR website. This article is titled, U.S. Inflation is Surging and People Are Hopping Mad. Stay tuned for more. Prices of everyday items in the U.S. have surged during the pandemic, thanks to a toxic combination of staffing shortages and supply chain woes. The rising prices are souring the national mood and taking a political toll on President Biden. Grocery prices in October were 5.4% higher than a year ago, according to the latest Consumer Price Index. Overall inflation was 6.2%, the highest annual figure in more than 3 decades. High inflation poses a particular challenge for people on fixed incomes, like Rink, a retiree in Washington, D.C. She relies on Social Security and her monthly benefit of $1,578 doesn't stretch as far as it used to. According to the U.S. government's tally, chicken prices in October were 8.8% higher than a year ago. Beef prices have climbed even more. Energy prices are among the biggest drivers of inflation. Rink is paying almost 50% more for gasoline now than she did a year ago. and 28% more for the natural gas that she uses to heat her house. Winter bills are likely to be even higher for those who rely on heating oil, like Nick Apodikos, who shares a house in Boston with his 94-year-old mother. For my mom, even if it's 100 degrees out, she still is cold. He says, now it's going to be more cold. Heating oil prices have soared 59% in the last year. Nick's mom, Rose Apodius, also relies on Social Security. Like others on the program, her benefits will increase in January by 5.9%. That's the biggest cost of living increase that the U.S. government has granted in four decades, but it has already been eclipsed by inflation. Nick says, before you'd go to the store, and if you had $100, you could buy four bags of groceries and be happy. Now, you're lucky to get a bag, milk, orange, juice, eggs, plus the oil for the house, the water bills. It's just crazy. It's so much money. How is somebody supposed to survive? Both the White House and the Federal Reserve have described this inflationary spike as a temporary byproduct of the pandemic, which has snarled supply chains and kept a lot of people out of work.